This is Reader's Radar, scanning Indiana's literary journals for outstanding new short stories. In every episode, we talk with one journal's editor about these surprising publications, and you hear a short story recommended by that editor as something special. Reader's Radar is a production of Indiana Public Media and WFIU Public Radio. It's your forecast for great reading ahead. I'm your host and reader, Shane Lauder. Our featured journal on this episode is Driftless, a publication that defines itself with the subtitle Midwest Adventuring. Its content covers people, places, photographs, and storytelling from 12 Midwestern states. The print journal's aesthetic is simple, timeless design, and its quality in the reader's hands is solid and elegant. The publishers and creative directors of Driftless are Anna Powell Teeter and Leah Fithian, two professionals in photography, advertising, graphic design, and journalism. Leah Fithian is a commercial photographer in Chicago. With me in the studio is Anna Powell Teeter, who is also a photographer and a filmmaker in Bloomington, Indiana, with a degree in journalism from Indiana University. Anna, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Now, to begin, can you tell us how you and Leah met, and how did you decide to commit to publishing Driftless?
Leah and I met in Bloomington. We both attended the photography program at IU. She's a few years older than me, and so I met her not through school, but actually after. And I joined the Driftless Project about a year into its existence. The two of us just felt like there wasn't a proper platform for Midwest creatives and wanted to highlight what made this region so special and all of the people who were choosing to intentionally stay here and create work in this region. I know when I graduated, a lot of my friends and colleagues were moving to the East or West Coast, which seemed like a very natural direction for me to go. But I'd really found a sense of community in Bloomington that I love, and just didn't feel like I could leave quite yet. It just seemed like a really natural project to be able to put a lot of energy into.
How do you and Leah manage as long-distance business partners? Because she's still in Chicago, correct?
Correct. So she moved to Chicago a few years ago, and at first that was a little frightening, just to not know how we were going to kind of have to change our workflow and how we worked on the project. But it has actually been a really valuable thing to have her in Chicago because the business and the magazine has representation in two states. So we can be more places as a publication. You know, she can be at events in Chicago, meeting people, a little more tuned in to that area. And then I'm still here in Bloomington going to events and doing things like this and interviews and meeting people and just being aware of what's going on and what kind of work is being made. And so we have a lot of phone calls and a lot of FaceTime dates, and we're always texting back and forth about different questions and ideas. We build the magazine usually over a video chat, kind of set aside a few hours every week and just work on it together.
I'm going to read from Wikipedia on the geographical Driftless area. The Driftless area is a region in Minnesota, Wisconsin, northwestern Illinois, and northeastern Iowa that was never glaciated. The term includes the Paleozoic Plateau, which contains deeply carved river valleys and extends into southeastern Minnesota and northeastern Iowa. Its rugged terrain is due to both the lack of glacial deposits, or drift, and to the incision of the Upper Mississippi River and its tributaries into bedrock. Why did you and Leah choose Driftless as the journal's name?
The Driftless area is a really, really beautiful part of the Midwest. It seemed like a very good representation for the magazine, but then we also kind of conceptualized the term to talk about creative people and individuals who choose to stay here instead of maybe drifting to the East or West Coast.
That's wonderful. So people who don't drift away, but who stay.
Yes.
The story in issue 9 is Test Surfaces by Bella Bravo, who is a writer here in Bloomington. Why did you choose this story for publication?
I was so excited when I saw an email from Bella in our inbox. Their work is so beautiful, and I really fell in love with it through their book, The Unpositioned Parts, which is a collection of short stories published by Monster House Press. The story is really unique. The character development in it was something that immediately struck me, kind of how the story is told from many different vantage points, including Margot, who is blind.
In a moment, we'll hear Test Surfaces by Bella Bravo. IndianaPublicMedia.org is your online station for award-winning news and timeless music, and for stories on the dazzling creativity everywhere in the Hoosier State. Scroll down on our About page for links to archive stories about publishing and interviews with authors of every genre. Hear poetry from Indiana on The Poet's Weave at IndianaPublicMedia.org. And now, Test Surfaces by Bella Bravo. At the end of summer, the students returned to town, and traffic surged. A tire screech cut through the news streaming over Margot's headphones. She flinched, her fingers tensed against the countertop. Since childhood, large blind spots had obfuscated the center of her vision. Sometimes she could see motion in her periphery. Ripples and smudges of a limited grayscale would correspond to light, shadow, and their shifts, though no movement came through on this occasion. The cause of the commotion stayed outside the restaurant. No stir from the kitchen, so Margot let the disruption pass. 3 days a week, Margot worked the register at Arturo's Pizza with a rotation of her friends on cook and delivery. A year ago, her friend Chatty Kathy recommended Margot for the cashier job. Before Arturo, the owner, called Margot to inquire about her interest in availability, he installed a braille mat over the register and a talking point-of-sale system so he could meaningfully offer her the position. Arturo was a punk in his late 50s, kind but reticent and old-fashioned in a way. He respected a long-standing reciprocal relationship with local, unkempt youth, a steady diet of otherwise fungible couriers and counterhelp who didn't steal from the drawer and perform nominal tasks at a human rate and closing tasks like Miracle Whip, smooth with some zip, in exchange for humane paychecks and healthy tips from the loyal lunch clientele. The kitchen kept full playlist sovereignty. Tonight, Arturo was in the back, so Margot had one headphone in. The door hanger jangled, and sneakers quickly scuffed the welcome mat. Margot's hand rose to greet her friend. A car almost hit some girl! Margot pulled her headphone out somewhat unnecessarily, since Chatty Cathy's reports always came at a volume above her surroundings, in this case the radio, oven hood whirls, and hums of a vintage Coke mini-fridge. Was she okay?
Not sure.
Chatty Cathy plopped onto the counter.
The car cut hard and missed her, I think. She's still stumbling through the intersection, though, but it was weird.
Two sharp clangs from the kitchen bell cut her off. Maybe she didn't see the car, said Margot. Unfortunately for her, last week Chatty Cathy dyed her hair lime green, and since then was either chewing on the split ends or riffing on how the color wasn't quite right.
Oh, it was weird out there. As the car was coming, I felt like I walked into a movie, but not like onto a movie set, like I was walking from one frame into another.
What do you mean? Margot remembered movies. A dark room, people, and color moving around in a rectangle, a slight glow. She didn't bother with them now.
Like, everyone was watching this girl!
Hair muffled Chatty Cathy's voice.
But it was like everyone was already replaying the moment as they were watching.
I thought you said the car didn't hit her.
Yeah, but it didn't seem to really matter if she actually got hit.
You don't think you'd feel differently if a car ran into this girl?
Oh, yeah, totally. But the part that's weird is I could tell everyone was expecting it.
Margot tensed her shoulders, unsure with whom she identified in the story. The imperiled girl, or the witnesses, or her friend, the witness's witness.
I don't know. It felt permanent, like I watched her become the girl in the car accident.
Archer called over the kitchen noise.
Last order for the night.
All right.
See you in a bit. Outside of holding cell one, a girl receives her flats. Underwear, sports bra, t-shirt, and jean skirt. In the elevator, roughshod eyes from guards and other inmates run her over. The skirt slips on. It's easy to put her in a skirt. She leaves the orange jumpsuit on the floor. It can be the floors now. She had slept, but woke up after her liver processed the alcohol. Through a sequence of door buzz clearances, the smell of urine, baked mouth, thrush, tin, and athlete's foot beg at her tongue, her lips too dry to recoil.
The universe couldn't have made this any easier. She takes a step outside. The alley behind the jail is tight, moving in her flats, against the ground. Each step has to stretch reality. Her shoes weigh more than she does in her skin. The wind tunnels and pushes against her face like hands. She shuffles through the airstream and pulls her jacket close. A foreign body odor escapes from her collar. Her senses stall. A green-haired girl quickly passes from one end of her periphery to the other. A seagull shriek forces her to feel again. Her head hurts her. She won't go any lower than her head. Unthinkingly, she follows the girl like a mosquito, an exoskeleton full of someone else's blood. The green hair leads her out from behind the jail into the civil twilight. She receives a momentary blindness from a headlight. Her eyes well, her skin falls off her. The green hair vanishes behind a door. The girl misses the beacon. A breeze brushes the girl's hair against her neck, and a sting reveals a bruise. Some car horns join the shrieks, so in the middle of the intersection, she needs to decide whether to complete the cross or to retreat. A silver car approaches, close enough for her to touch. So she does. She touches the car, tests its solid, unyielding surface. She needs her skin back. This thought collects some of her faculties and simple wants under her fingertips. She wishes her cell phone wasn't dead, so she could ask her roommate to take her home. She wishes her mom would come care for her. After all, she's hurt. But the thought of asking feels like unbuilding. She thinks through her foundational moments. How she fumed with contempt at her mom, but never asked why she wasn't allowed to go to sleepovers after a certain age. How she ran without fear at dark. How she worked the night shift at an independent bookstore. How she had sex in her boyfriend's dorm. How she walked to and from the corner store unaccompanied, how she informed herself about candidates and not just the women's issues, how she smirked at women's groups handing out pepper spray at orientation, and finally, how she drove to their apartment, walked up the stairs, through the door, said hello without qualm, drank their ready drink, and laughed at herself under their laughter. She crushes herself. With it all built as it is, her mom won't come because she won't tell. She won't tell until she has a child who will inherit her skin. At first, her skin will feel comforting in her hands, but also like a nettle sting. Then, as it leaves her palms and takes her shape, the child will come to look strange. So she will grab the child and separate it from her memories of last night, until a moment in the fervor forces her to explain to the child what she does not have. Because she understands the skin still as something of value that was hers and taken, and why she's so very careful with that child who has her skin. Quickly now, the survival moment. Get out. Get out of the room. Get the keys. Get the phone. Get out of the apartment. Get downstairs. Get the car door open. Get behind the wheel. Get the engine going. Get away. Girl, get out of the road. There's one direction. And the reverse. A series of survival moments follows this line, back and forth, as though there is no history. Every attempted accumulation slips and falls between her synapses. After closing, Margot threw cool water on her face. Her grandmother had told her to give herself a splash every morning and night. When cold water contacts with the human face, it triggers a specific set of physiological responses. The heart rate slows down, so the bloodstream needs less oxygen, leaving more for other organs like the brain. Her grandmother had said, "The slowed heart rate may be a residual response to pressure on the umbilical cord when it cuts off oxygen during birth, but science doesn't really know." Her grandmother enjoyed the loose ends. Who knows? It's a natural facelift, too. The telephone was her grandmother's favorite invention. Her grandmother, an old nurse, lived alone, except for one summer with Margot. The first meal that her grandmother ate in the United States was the best hamburger in the world. Shortly before immigrating, she gave birth to Margot's mother. Before that, her grandmother denounced Catholicism and divorced her first husband. Before that, her grandmother had been a doctor in a southern city near the border of Colombia and Ecuador. Before that, she married a fellow medical student. Before that, her family relocated from a cattle village to the city. Before that, She lost her older brother to the violence, a period of civil unrest that Marco cannot understand. Before that, she fed, watered, and sheared a few Front Ager sheep and cared for the goat. Before that, she loved the taste of guinea pig, quie. In the restaurant bathroom, Margot repeated to herself, "The body instinctively saves the brain." Grasping the rim of the sink, Margot felt fake porcelain. When Margot's eyesight started to blur, she went to live with her grandmother, who instructed Margot on their first night together to demonstrate how she bathed. A thin layer of grit awakened on her skin, and next to the milk-white porcelain tub with the black teardrop feet, Margot answered that she hadn't thought of it before. With warm water and a sponge, her grandmother scoured Margot's hands, feet, and knees. Then she passed the sponge and teased, "Remember to wash all the places your mother tells you not to touch." Her grandmother enjoyed undoing the ends of others as well. After the bath, she'd wrapped Margot's girl body with a coarse towel and polished her off with a thorough hand rake down her sides, shoulders to ankles. "Next time you can do this without me, Miguelita." A terse knock on the bathroom door pierced Margot's memory. Her muscles clenched together and her hand grasped for the bathroom wall. She traced the wall to the plastic molding around the door. Her palm opened in a slide down to the small knob. "I'm heading out. Do you need a ride?" In alone moments, Arturo seemed meek to Margot. Once she told him so, but he misheard her. He assumed she'd said weak and laughed, assuming she'd meant it as a joke. "No, I think Kathy's coming back to get me."
"She's been gone a while. You sure she didn't forget?"
"Yeah, I'll call her in a sec. It's cool." Margot heard the buzz from fluorescent lights cut out and the door jingle. She slipped the headphones in her ear and listened to the day's many voicemails from her grandmother. Though born preternaturally ready to offer counsel, the proliferation of phone access had offered her grandmother perpetually ready recipients. Late age seemingly imbued her grandmother with urgency. Adages now comprised her message. "Always, your senses give information, but you give the choice. Remember, you cannot give you. There's no taking either." Her grandmother's voice sounded like Margot's memory of it. Crisp respiration reflected alertness, a rolling rhythm for stability, and a low decibel for intimacy. Margot couldn't tell if the past had power over her perception of the voicemails, or her hearing had the power to rewrite the memory of her grandmother's voice. Or, she thought, perhaps her grandmother's physical voice had not changed in a decade. "You walk, you stretch, you extend into the world because your brain gives you movement, not just the sense of it." Like augury, Margot could translate. Her grandmother was telling her to be careful when crossing the street and when trusting strangers. With her attention on her grandmother's speech streams, Margot weaved through the tables and placed the chairs on top. With Margot positioned like this, she seemed common, a girl laboring at her place of work, a figure moving through an environment. She didn't need her cane inside the restaurant anymore. While living together, Margot would help her grandmother with the laundry. Washing the dirt and blood from her t-shirts and underwear, her grandmother explained, "As you do everything you do, your choice, your ability to choose, will come from a thing that you cannot give and that another cannot take." Margot's summer bare arms pulled the clothing out of the warm wash tub and handed each article for her grandmother to wring. Her grandmother hummed a little between sentences. "It's strange, but you'll feel this thing that is inside of you by physical contact with what's around you." Margot savored her grandmother's words, her hum, the warmth from the water, and the rhythm between her grandmother's voice and the slosh in the basin. In the last weeks with her grandmother, bitterness settled in, resentment about her body as it changed, rapidly expanding and withdrawing in unpredictable ways under her skin and over her retinas. "But Miguelita, the body gives you this thing, this guiding ability to feel, smell, touch, and hear," her grandmother admonished. "The more you understand you as a part and not a whole, the more you'll feel an urge to walk. But this urge will be balanced with an impulse to test a surface before you step." When Margot realized her eyesight wasn't a mistake, she floated. Despondent, she grieved, imagining how the gray smears across the sky would opacify to black, like the teardrops under the porcelain tub. In lieu of staying in bed all day, her grandmother carried and laid Margot in the yard. All of Margot dripped from her grandmother's warm, weighty arms, the size of Margot's thighs, into the soft grass and ground redolent of washing soap. She felt how she was from her grandmother. When her transformation was complete, Margot returned to live with her mother. She had little vision to speak of, and the smell of laundry followed her. The front door jangled. Air and the sounds of traffic rushed into the pizza place. Arturo called, "Margot, could you come here?" An unfamiliar strain in his voice clipped the rise of his inflection, so the question sounded like a command. Margot hurried through the restaurant, keeping her elbows bent but her hands out in front, catching the table corners. As she stepped outside, her hearing adjusted to the exposure. A light summer wind filled in the intermittent pattern of city traffic. Then a sob leapt up from the sidewalk in front of her, and then a hush, followed by another sob, and again the pattern of broken breaths. A woman, Margot thought. A girl, perhaps? But it was not Chatty Cathy. "She seems hurt."
"Did she say where?"
"No, she told me to fuck off."
"Well, how do you know she's hurt, then?"
"Intuition." Margot felt Arturo shift behind her and assumed they were then facing the girl.
"Who is she?" said Margot, and kneeled.
The girl's breath stabilized. "He doesn't know me." She spoke quickly in one breath, a natural weapon like fire.
"Well, I'm Margot."
Arturo's leg brushed against her back. As he moved closer, the girl scrambled, and the light pressure from Arturo's leg quickly disappeared. He stepped back.
"I'll get her some water."
The door jangled, and his shoes scuffed the front mat. A car sped by, and Margot, still squatting, inched away from the trail of sound.
"What's your name?"
The girl stirred, but otherwise was silent. In a rush of fear, Margot thought of her cane stowed behind the counter. She couldn't remember how far from the door or how far from the curb she was. She was alone with a stranger.
"Wanna tell me if you're hurt?"
"It doesn't matter."
"Well, how can I help you then?"
A whimper escaped the girl. Margot realized the girl hadn't stopped crying fully. Her instinct triggered. Margot whispered in low, even tones to coax the girl towards calm. The door jangled again. "Here." As Margot extended her arm towards Arturo's voice, the girl moved suddenly, standing up from the sidewalk. The concrete scratched along the coarse fabric that she was wearing. It sounded like denim. Margot met Arturo's hand reaching for her wrist. He helped Margot up and then guided a paper cup of water into her hand.
"I gotta go home."
"Arturo can drive you."
"No, no."
The traffic and wind overpowered the girl's voice.
"Margot can't drive you." "I'll walk then."
The girl brushed past Margot. The temperature finally started to drop, and goosebumps crept up Margot's arms.
"I thought you were hurt."
"It's not that kind of hurt."
"Well, what kind is it?"
"It's impolite to ask questions you already know the answers to."
The girl's light soles clapped against the concrete for a few paces, and then the pitch of her gait changed, a bit lower, as though she was striking a denser surface like well-packed gravel and sun-soaked tar, still warm after nightfall. She was in the road.
"Please be careful. Cars zip through here," said Arturo. "You can't tell me to be careful."
"I couldn't help you if you got hurt," said Margot.
"Your friend is itching to be a knight in shining armor,"
the girl shouted. A roadside sodium lamp created a dark, murky backdrop. Arturo whispered over Margot's shoulder, "Do you think she'll come back if I go inside? Give it a sec." Searching for a hint of movement, Margot tilted her head from side to side. She was out of practice. She rarely bothered with sight anymore. A close whoosh from a passing car brought Arturo's hand onto her shoulder. A honk prompted, "This is ridiculous." Margot asked the girl, "Could you get out of the road?"
"I told you it doesn't matter."
"You can test your resentment out on me. It's okay, but could you do it on the sidewalk?" An ambulance siren pulsed a few blocks away, and Margot imagined the vibrations washing over the girl before they hit her ear. She waited for a sign of movement from the girl, and then she pressed her right foot forward. Her arms instinctively rose to guide and guard her through space. With two steps, the wind swept away Arturo's body heat. With three, her toes followed the curb down to the asphalt. She kept the paper cup level and slid her left foot forward.
"Are you crazy?"
"Keep talking. I can tell where you are when you talk." The night air slowly siphoned the heat from the road. The goosebumps on Margot's arms disappeared. "I need something from you."
"I need you to leave me alone."
"I'm not going to tell you what doesn't kill you makes you stronger."
A few feet away, a car passed in the other direction, and Margot pressed forward like a slug.
You're going to tell me it could be worse?
When I was 10, I had to relearn everything, and my mom kind of broke down, so I went to live with my grandmother, and she taught me how to use a cane, how to read, how to bathe, how to wash my clothes, all without relying on my eyes. Margot raised the paper cup to the center of her abdomen, where she would hold her cane in this moment if she had it. So I trust her completely. Margot could hear the girl's breath, another step. But she tells me not to trust anyone completely. Close enough, she stopped.
Margot, called Archero. I want to come get you, but I don't think that's what you want.
She turned toward Archero without moving her feet. One more minute.
I don't like this.
The girl's hand brushed Margot's outstretched arm and pulled her a few feet.
There, you're in between the yellow lines.
But Margot still could not feel the girl's body heat. And where are you then? The light from a sodium lamp extinguished. Everything was flat black.
We covered this already. It's impolite to ask questions when you know.
I think it's impolite to assume what other people know.
How can I get you back on the sidewalk?
You can lead me.
Try again.
Then first, I need your help testing something that my grandmother told me. Margot stretched her right hand in an arc in front of her, hoping to catch the girl. Could you step in between the yellow? The girl shuffled and touched Margot's wrist from a different direction, an action to confirm the girl's adjustment. But she kept her hand there, and Margot appreciated the warmth. Here we are. Margot turned to face the girl's voice. My grandmother insists that we find our way through the world around us. So, like the environment is the extension of the body, and we're constantly extending the limits of ourselves as we move through our environment, like we're always testing the surface, both of ourselves and the world around us. But here's the thing. She says no matter how unstable the terrain, every move is a choice. The girl dropped her hand from Margot's arm, and her voice dropped to a mutter.
I don't think I can have this conversation right now.
Margot offered the paper cup to the girl. Do you want some water? The girl tried to hold back weeping with long breaths sucked from the wind between each word.
I can't put anything in.
What if you just splash your face? I think it could help pause everything for a second. Margot felt the subtle weight of the cup and the water transfer from her fingertips into the black. The girl drew in a breath and splash. A few drops returned to Margot on her cheek. The paper cup clunked against the ground, and Margot asked if the girl felt better.
I don't know what better could feel like right now.
It's all bad?
Maybe I feel a little more solid.
A low rumble crept through the wind.
Hey!
Archero's voice clipped again in the breeze. A single, high-pitched squeal pierced the air, sending a rush of adrenaline to knit every tissue of Margot's muscle into its neighbor, to mesh every piece against a foreign force that would otherwise make its way through her.
No!
Followed by two soft thunks, the girl and Archero collided into Margot's body as it compacted into something smaller and easier to defend. In a half second, they grew into one another. In the black, an old engine rumbled and a car door creaked open. Archero and the girl peeled off Margot, one limb at a time. At a decibel that could clear the road of physical debris, chatty Kathy's voice yanked Margot's neck and shoulders from their protective position.
Margot, get out of the road!
Chatty Kathy's hands, her briskness, sunk under Margot's armpits and helped her up from the asphalt.
Damn it, are you okay?
The air buzzed, and even after her palms furiously patted at Archero, the girl, and Chatty Kathy to confirm that everyone was intact, Margot's skin wouldn't stop crawling. She linked her arm through Chatty Kathy's and pulled her into a squat on the curb. Margot wanted to be low to the ground. She heard the door jangle twice. Archero slipped the handle of her cane between her fingers, placed his hand on her shoulder for a second, and said goodbye. Margot would thank him during their shift tomorrow. The sodium lamp came on and filled in Margot's periphery with a muddy gradient. A car whizzed past, and Margot flinched, though the world no longer felt like it would give way. Suddenly, she started to shake with cold and hunger. Chatty Cathy's voice trembled a little.
Margot can't stand in the middle of the road!
The girl cut her off.
It was my fault. She followed me.
Margot does what she wants, but in the future, I mean, the cars don't pay attention out here. Margot noted to herself that tomorrow she would explain to Chatty Cathy why she needed to be with the girl. She would take tonight to think about why she would do it all the same if she had to do it again.
Margot, ready to head out?
Yeah, but... Margot's jaw tightened, unsure if she was ready to be separated from the girl. Could you give my friend a ride, too?
Sure, if she wants one.
Margot hooked the strap of her cane around one wrist and extended her other hand up into the air. The girl grasped her wrist and lifted Margot's feet onto the sidewalk.
I'm not really sure where I am.
The girl paused. Margot could feel the girl's warm breath. A flash of thought of a warm shower loosened Margot's face, as though something within her leapt out and let each girl orient herself.
But, yeah, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Test Surfaces by Bella Bravo from the spring 2018 issue of Driftless. Bella Bravo was born in La Mesa, California, and now lives and writes in Bloomington, Indiana. Bravo is the author of the collection of queer short stories, The Unpositioned Parts, and the stage play, As Bad as They. They have been published by Driftless, Peach, Mask, Limestone Post, and Monster House Press. You've been listening to Reader's Radar, a presentation of WFIU Public Radio and Indiana Public Media, recorded at the studios of WFIU Public Radio on the campus of Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. Our producer is Shane Lauder. Production director is Mark Chilla. Digital director is Ayabon Binder. Executive producer is John Bailey. Music for this program is shared under Creative Commons license by the artists Lobo Loco, Blue Dot, and Maidan at freemusicarchive.org. Episodes are posted at our website, indianapublicmedia.org/readersradar, with links to more literary audio from WFIU Public Radio. I'm your host and reader, Shane Lauder. Keep listening, keep reading, keep an ear on the radar.